hope, resurrection in the face of death.
If I can just vent a bit here.
The question is, what is right in the sight of God?
Church is essential to being a human.
Well, 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 welcome along to another episode of Irreverend, giving it both barrels on faith and current affairs with me, the Reverend Jamie Franklin. It's great to be with you today. Now, before I introduce my good friend TJ Pelham, I'm going to ask him to imagine that there's some really pumping, energetic music in the background. So Tom, with that in mind, can you tell me, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good, Jamie. I'm good, thanks.
Excellent. Brilliant. Great. Well, it's good to see you, Tom. So full of energy.
It's been a long 3 weeks, hasn't it? I mean, you know, it's cat and counting.
3 weeks. 3 weeks. Yes. Yes. It was meant to be 3 weeks. It's actually been a year, and we'll get to that quite soon after we've introduced.
I'm good.
Yeah, yeah. Great. That's great. That's great. And we want to introduce our other co-host as well, who is, of course, the Reverend Daniel French, looking very bureaucratic in his church offices with his box files today. Daniel, how are you?
Keyboards, everything. Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you. Yeah, it's good to see you guys. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, well, it's great to be here with you guys. I'm so excited about this episode. We've got loads to talk about, as we always do, but I think especially this week. Now, chaps, I want to tell you about something very exciting that happened to me this week, if that's all right. I had a conversation with the one and only James Dellingpole. How cool is that?
Wow.
Amazing, amazing enthusiasm for you both there. Tom, you're not...
No, it's good.
I'm starstruck.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was awesome. I had such a good conversation with him, and I just felt like overwhelmingly positive, like we're kindred spirits, really. And he even spoke about me and our podcast with Laura Perrins on his podcast yesterday, and he referred to me as his vicar. Can you imagine that? I am now...
You are his chaplain.
Now. Yeah, it's essentially, I am now James Dellingpole's... guide in Christ, which is a great honor. I mean, he didn't quite say that, but you know, basically that was the implication of what he was saying. So it was just amazing. I just felt like, you know, as soon as he came on the Zoom thing, I just felt like, you know, this is like a match made in heaven almost. So it was a really positive conversation, and it'll be coming out on the Delling Pod next week. So if anyone's new, by the way, who's coming to us through Delling Pod, it's great to have you. And we've already about doubled our Twitter followers since he tweeted us out. So there'll undoubtedly be new people tuning in, and we welcome everybody in the Irreverend family. Everybody. Regardless of
including those in Sweden,
including people in Sweden and South Africa and California and Florida, the vaccinated, the unvaccinated, everybody is welcome here in this big, happy, irreverent family, because we do not discriminate. We're a non-discriminatory podcast. Isn't that right?
We're a broad church.
We are a broad church, indeed. Although we don't accept heresy. So
no.
Actually, that's a joke. That's a joke. We do, of course. Of course we accept. We robustly engage with heresy, but in a respectful, nice way, in an interesting way. Because, Tom, you're basically a heretic, and you're allowed to be on the podcast.
You've stumped him now.
He can't say anything. He's silenced by the truth. You're silenced by the truth. I want to know something that happened this week. We got a couple of emails saying that the banter at the beginning of the last episode was too long. What do you make of that?
Yeah.
Do you think...
I think we talked possibly about breakfast series for too long.
Yeah, we need to flatten the curve.
squash the Cheerio sombrero.
My wife did say the same thing. She said, I tried to listen to it, but you just talked about breakfast cereals and it got boring. So I said, oh, fair enough. What can I say to that?
Yeah, well, no, I can understand that. I mean, I asked Dellingpole about it, and he just said we should just do what feels right, which I like as a kind of life philosophy. But I don't know. I think maybe it was slightly too long, the banter last week. It was 20 minutes. But, you know, I found it very amusing. So you know, it's hard, isn't it? Sometimes that's what my wife says to me. Sometimes she says, oh, you know, you think you're really funny, but other people don't. So do you know what I mean? It's hard because you want to entertain people, but at the same time, if you like
cruel, but kind, cruel, but kind.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, chaps, I want to do a first here, okay? This is a first for the podcast. Somebody has sent me some awesome music to play, okay? So I'm going to play this music now. And honestly, you're gonna love this. This piece is by, and what is it? Who is it?
It's not by Justin Welby, is it? It's not, because we saw we did that last week.
No, this is real stuff, okay? This is Gabs. And this is a piece called Fight for Your Rights, Beef for Salvation. Okay, you'll get the gist of it. Right, I'm going to share this now. Here we go. This is Fight for Your Rights. Ooh. Beef for Salvation.
For my rights, so fight, so fight,
so fight, so fight, so fight.
Yo, yo, yo.
For my rights,
so fight, so fight, so fight. Yo, yo. It's like 5G's coming here. Next wave. Part of the plan, first phase. Mark of the beast living in the last days. He who lasts last is the one who prays. Will you stay strong? Will you conform? Will you accept all of these new norms? I feel sorry for these newborns growing up in this world with these new laws. Yo, it's like it don't make sense. Some people think a mask is a form of defense, and the others do it just to comply. And if you ask, they say it don't feel right. I tell my brothers in the trap, it's a trap, G. Where you gonna trap when there's no cash? They must be mad if they think they're gonna vax me. They must be mad if they think they're gonna track me. Not part of a group, I'm an individual. I still got my life and that is God's miracle. But what happens when you die in the physical? Walk one for your soul in the spiritual. And now I've changed, I hope the old me is ancient. But for now some guys have gotta be patient. They're trying to make us robots, but we're God's creation. I'll be for my rights and I'll fight for salvation. Be for my rights, fight for salvation.
Think
I care if you're black, white or Asian. We need to unite and this is not a conversation. But blacks never get in that equation. No, I don't say BLM, but of course I care about all my black friends.
There we are.
No, we don't say BLM, but
love
of course
that.
We care about all our black friends.
So big shout out to Ask Gabs there. That's great, isn't it? Do you guys love that? There we are. Boys, how great was that?
It's very good, Jim. It's got a lot of energy, hasn't it? I liked it.
It's so full of energy. I love the way it turns into something else at the end about the, you know, the race stuff as well. No, we don't say BLM, but of course we care about all our black friends. Love that. It's a great rhyming couplet, isn't it? So
maybe it could be included on the Church of England's official Sunday
in February.
Oh, what was it? Is it called Racial Awareness Sunday? It passed me by this year. I don't know how. I just didn't notice it was happening.
A lot has passed me by.
Well, I mean, there's a 5-year commission, isn't there now, to help us, you know, make sure this doesn't pass us. But it's probably your unconscious bias there, Jamie. That you know, they didn't talk to you.
Well, I don't understand because I don't see how it could be unconscious bias when nobody told me about it. Maybe I should have looked harder.
That's how unconscious. It's a double bluff. That's doubly unconscious.
I didn't see it in my Book of Common Prayer calendar.
I'm not sure you would have done. No.
No.
And we also have to. They want to sort of decolonialize the curriculum at college. And I tell you, I mean, Cuddeston was not, not particularly. Broad, I guess, in some senses, but actually we did get, I mean, Cuddeston's basically a sort of middle-class country club for aspiring vicars in many ways. But in other ways, we did get exposed to quite a bit of African theology, I think it's fair to say. Kathy Ross spoke about it quite a lot. I did papers on Ubuntu, which is quite an interesting concept. I think
Wasn't Kathy Ross, isn't she African?
Well, I mean, yes, she is. Of course she is. No, she's not. She lived in Africa, but she's New Zealand.
Oh, yeah, that's it. Similar accents.
Kind of. Yeah, well, there you go with your unconscious bias again.
You think she's
so? We did. So, you know, I don't think. You know, and I engage very seriously with chunks of black theology, which is really nice. So I don't think there's any particular sense in which I didn't, you know, I didn't really seek to have a broad education, but I got one anyway because it was interesting. It stood on its own merits. Ubuntu, the idea that it's not our individuality is not sort of Descartian, the I, but it's actually the we, it's the community, is a really powerful thought that they've come up, that they, you know, express in African community. It's a lived out philosophy. And it, you know, it stands on its own merits as something that's interesting and you want to go and talk to it. It's a bit like, you know, and I take it and I use it. Why not? Well, it's probably cultural appropriation there, isn't it?
I was going to say it's a horrendous act of cultural appropriation, really, but it's a bit of a bind, isn't it? I mean, do we want to go into this right now? Because I wanted to start with the good news about the Scottish Church this year.
Start with the good news.
Yeah, let's go. We'll come back to this, Tom, because I mean, as you might expect, I've got quite a lot to say about it. But so good news. Yes.
Good news.
Yes. Hey. We've got some great news this week. This must be the best news since Neil Ferguson committed a crime and got kicked off the Sage Committee last year, which was good news. Unfortunately, he's back, which is a shame, but it's still a good moment. This is a better moment, I would say, because there's been a victory for Scottish church leaders who have won their legal case. The judge has ruled that the government acted unconstitutionally when criminalising gathered worship. So this is great news. Let's read some of it. Handing down judgment, Lord Braid also ruled that online worship is not real Christian worship, stating that it is not for the Scottish ministers to, quotation, dictate to the petitioners or to the additional party that henceforth, or even for the duration of the pandemic, worship is to be conducted online. No. That might be an alternative to worship, but it is not worship. At very best for the respondents, in modern parlance, it is worship light. Well, there we go. It's interesting, isn't it?
It's good, isn't it? Do you know, what's really interesting is that all similar court cases that were brought in England were kicked out well before they got to the stage of a judge actually looking at the merits of the case. They were kicked out before that point because essentially the judges kept ruling that they were matters that were political and not legal. So he's saying that the right, that they kept saying, you know, that the place to oppose the legislation was not in the courts but in Parliament, which is a bit of double standards because, of course, we had the whole incredibly quick one about the the Boris Johnson's shutting down of Parliament and the Supreme Court case.
The proroguing of Parliament around
Prorogging of Parliament, which was pretty much a definition of a court going political as it happened, and I can't say I agreed with that court case. But that be that as it may, you know, they've not got that far. They've not been allowed to get that far by our judiciary. Whereas in Scotland, it got to that stage, and the judge did say yes, their rights have been taken away. Now, of course, right to religion isn't our only right that's been taken away. I mean, it's an important one, but you know, the right to free assembly, right to a family life, right to all of the other things, which a judge in England actually said that Zoom constituted accessing the right to family life in one of his replies, you know, online. You know, so it's nice to hear a judge actually coming up with some common sense sort of stuff and it getting that far. It's a shame.
A couple of things that came to mind. One, as a little appendix to this, was that the Scottish Episcopal Church, some time back, had released a press statement saying that the Episcopal Church officially was not going to get involved with this campaign and was not part of the 500 signatories who put their neck out on this.
Phone's ringing, Daniel.
Oh yeah, that's the office phone. I'm in the parish office, so
yeah.
I can't really disconnect it. But yeah,
talking, I think we won't hear really, the message.
That was really interesting, the letter that he wrote was really wet.
Yeah,
and disgraceful, to be honest. I'm not going to be vindictive, but you know, if one wanted to be vindictive, you could say you can't, you haven't won this.
Yeah.
and perhaps you should remain closed, you know.
Indeed. Let's listen to the statement that Janice Scott, QC, made, representing the 27 Scottish church leaders. This is excellent. Church leaders do not lightly take to the law. My note of argument makes no apology for starting with a statement, and that is Jesus is Lord, because that encapsulates the issue as far as the petitioners are concerned. The Scottish ministers have presented these 27 church leaders and very many more ministers, church elders and ordinary members of congregation with a deep crisis. As Christians, their primary obedience is to God and not to the state, and there is a fundamental obedience in regular communal public worship. Regular communal public worship is a central part of the Christian's life of faith and of the church's being. And to be absolutely clear, this is not about buildings, it's about assembly of congregations. The sacraments of communion and baptism and the ministry between members of a church are integral aspects of expression of what it is to be a Christian and to belong to a Christian church. The petitioners would say that faith is a matter of hope in life and in death, and it's more than mere obedience, and that it is essential, particularly at a time of national crisis. What a wonderful...
I think that's quite good that something essential around Christianity is recognised legally in this, this particular milieu of secularity. Because, recall, you chaps might recall about sort of 10, 12 years ago when there was a whole series of court cases about, Christians sort of wearing crosses in the workplace or having a palm cross on your... on your work van, and that these were deemed non-essential, and it seemed at the time like the judges and the law lords were minded to say that there was nothing really essential to Christianity in its public manifestation. Yep. Everything was up for grabs. And I think what's good about this is this says actually what the one thing that is essential for Christianity and for Christians is gathering in physical space. I've decided not to use this term, so I'm going to use it in person. I've noticed lots of websites, cathedral websites this week are putting on, we're going to have services mostly online, but some in person. I think that there is services and then there are digital gatherings, but liturgy is basically a corporate act.
It's a
flesh and blood act. If you dive into what the meaning of corporate is, because it's often thrown around, people sort of assume corporations, but actually it means body. It's derived from corpus. It's a physical interaction. It's meeting.
Jonathan Pageau, the American symbologist who does Symbolic World YouTube site, has done a very good piece this week on this, actually, on the dangers of things like Zoom in terms of our perception. As great as it is talking to you chaps here on Zoom, we know lots of people, don't we? Perhaps we know ourselves who are Zoomed out. And that it's having a sort of neurological effect on people. And it's having an effect on how we are negotiating the world and even cyberspace. So it's changing our perception of reality. He had some interesting stuff to talk about, the whole idea of digital church. And I think this is where particularly the C of E is attempting, I think, rather very incorrectly at the moment, to push forward this idea of a digital church. We've talked about this before, haven't we? But as if it's on par.
It's doing the church is doing what it has a tendency to the liberal church to do, which is to innovate and then reflect, and sort of finally bring the Bible into it. So they'll do something and then they'll justify it. Whereas really, I think mission works the other way around. It flows out of the Word of God and into the world. I say they do this quite a lot because it's the whole process of what they call theological reflections. I've had to be writing a few recently for my curacy submission. And they are, again, the wrong way around, really, because you go out, you have an experience.
Yeah.
then you apply the Bible to it, and then you reflect on it. And I guess there's validity in doing that.
But I think you got that wrong, man. I think what you do is you go out and have an experience, then you think about the experience, and then you come to a conclusion, and then you use the Bible and theological categories
to justify it. Yeah,
to justify yes. reflection.
Reflection.
It's like the opposite of how everyone's done theology forever, basically.
Yeah. So I think, and I think the church has sort of leaped into the online. It was forced to by the government. To be fair, we've all done online services. All of us.
I haven't done any online services.
You're not. I did them, and they were kind of they were the only thing we could do this time last year.
Yeah, you could have done nothing.
We could have done nothing. I think I'm glad I didn't.
I say that, but my TI wrote letters to parish. He's been doing a newsletter with devotions in it for the last year. We've been making phone calls.
Which is a good thing, and I think, you know, in a way, a letter. And Zoom are not dissimilar in terms of what their function is. But in the sense that they communication, but they're not. It's not the same as being in person. So I think the letter church is in a sense fine. I mean, Paul was able to pastor his churches from afar via letter. That's, you know, a good chunk of the New Testament. But he wouldn't have said that made up for, you know, he definitely says at times, you know, he might be with you with spirit, but he's not there in body, and he'd like to be.
They were still meeting as congregations. The thing about the epistolary tradition of the New Testament, so the idea of people sending letters backwards and forwards, what that actually shows is totally the opposite, I would say, of the spirit that online church has been embraced with, which is a desire for connection. Right. So the whole point is, Paul keeps on saying, I long to be with you. You know, I hope and I pray that, you know, I'll be released from prison, or I'll get over this sickness, and I'll be able to come and see you in person. Right. The letter is not enough. But in my absence, I'm sending this person with this letter so that he can at least represent something of my personal presence to you. And of course, those people were traveling for weeks and perhaps even months, and they were literally risking their lives to deliver these letters, right? So that whole tradition totally mitigates against the idea that there's something legitimate or analogous between sitting at home on Zoom, gathering as a church, and actually gathering as a church. Paul put the highest level of priority upon Christians gathering together. And also in this article, which I've actually just taken down. Oh yeah, here it is. It makes this point, right? It is important because it is no exaggeration to say that over the centuries, Christians have died in the defense of the public worship in the church. And Christians continue to die in the defense of the public worship in church. There is an irreconcilable conflict between the obedience of the Christian church, their God, or God and obedience to the state. And that is one of the principal criticisms I would make of people who are advocating Zoom church as somehow equivalent to actual church. If it's not such a big deal to meet together in person, why have people down the centuries sacrificed their lives for it? Why have people died for it? Why have they risked other people's lives for it, including their families, including their friends? If we embrace this ideology of Zoom church, we are literally betraying the memory of people who have been martyred for meeting together to worship Jesus Christ. So it's an extreme...
And are being martyred at this present moment.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
I've done a lot of FaceTime live stuff.
Yeah.
But I've not warmed so much. We've done the Zoom church bit. We're stopping it. We've actually stopped it last Sunday. We're going to do sort of Zoom evening prayer for those who want. But I mean, I've opened up all my churches fully now for worship. From Great. Palm Sunday onwards, we've always had a church open, and we've always had worship apart from the first lockdown when there was those constraints. Yeah. I have to say that what I've tried to argue is maybe a subtlety that some have lost is that at least in the live streaming, you're putting a window into something that's happening physically.
Yeah.
That's so people in our case are getting a window into the Eucharistic celebration with the hope, and this is something that's repeatedly said on the broadcast, that you will be able to come to this.
Yeah.
Or that we may be able to bring communion to you, that there will be a physical contact as a consequence of this. So it is a window into something. It is not the experience per se. Whereas I think Zoom, it locates the church in this virtual world, you know, in a way that I'm a bit uncomfortable with, to say the least. There's no way to go. I mean, we've had this. I'm sure you've had this too. People who said, "Oh, it's great, you know, I can go to church in my pajamas, or I can switch off at certain points and, you know, have my breakfast." And so on and so on. You know, as you say, does that honour the people, the many around the world, the millions around the world, who risk everything for that brief physical contact with the community?
I think this is an appropriate time to bring up a document we were sent, because I think it speaks to this. A friend of mine got in contact, and thank you very much for that. He said, I haven't seen him in many years. We used to ring bells together. And
yes, Tom.
Rebel
bell ringers.
And he said to me, thank you very much for your very kind email. And he sent this extraordinary document from the Diocese of Bath and Wells called Where Are We Now? Our Diocesan Snapshot. And basically, if you thought what Daniel was saying was bad or an exaggeration, this document goes further. My favourite quotes are from a vicar. It's terrible to say, but I'm glad we didn't have to do Easter.
Yeah, amazing.
At which point I almost fell off my chair.
But the inconvenience of it, eh?
Oh, yeah. Jesus would have just stayed dead, and then we would have never had to do Easter.
If I told my husband I wanted to get up to go to church, he would make it difficult, but this way I can go and he doesn't know. That's another quote. And, you know, I can sympathise, obviously, with people whose spouses try and prevent them going to church. And I could see there being, you know, perhaps Zoom being a way of doing that. However, if, as I suspect, it's more of a inconvenience than anything else, then going to church is, you know, actually sending a message to your husband that sort of secretly going to Zoom isn't, i.e. it's saying this is important to me, even if it causes us conflict. Now, obviously, if it's a matter of sort of abuse or something like that, that needs to be dealt with. You shouldn't be in a relationship where your husband is preventing you from going to church. But I strongly suspect it's more to do with, you know, he'd make it difficult, more like, you know, oh, I needed the car to go to see football rather than anything else, you know. So how, you know, Zoom church just doesn't send that signal, this is important. It's sort of various really odd sort of things, like how it talks. I don't know where they get these people from.
I was just gonna raise that question of who actually are these people, because at one stage it says, for example, that one of the main narratives in church circles is about how well churches have responded to the pandemic. I mean, to be honest, boys, I've hardly heard anyone say that, and I've spoken to lots of people about this, not just, you know, lockdown skeptics and people like that, but let me be clear. I don't know a single person who still watches Zoom church, and I know quite a lot of people whose churches are putting on Zoom church. Now, they all started watching Zoom church, but they don't anymore, and it's not just that they have sort of fallen out of the habit. It's like literally they found it drained the life out of them, and they can't bring themselves to watch it anymore. And I've had conversations. I had a conversation with someone this week, and I won't say it was, but basically this person was telling me that their kids have totally become estranged from any semblance of Christian faith that they had because they haven't gone to church for a year, right? They don't care about Zoom.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is one of the ironies of this, is this is clearly this has got clearly a boomer locked dimension to it.
It has
estranged several generations.
Yeah.
Because I can tell you, if you've had a week on Microsoft Teams as a child, as a teenager, the last thing you're going to want to do is sit in front of a screen for 45 minutes and an hour and watch the vicar's favourite YouTube clips. I mean, you know, as well, me, I've done it myself. I've enjoyed, you know, I used to be an IT specialist. I kind of enjoyed it to a point, but, you know, this isn't connecting with Instagram generation.
No.
And it's not connecting with toddlers. And actually, if you look at the Church of England numbers for their Sunday national service, the last, I think it was two Sundays ago, they had 1,700 people watched, at the end of Sunday, had watched that video. You know, that doesn't sound like a digital future to me. That sounds pretty poor.
That's for the whole nation, right? For 67
minutes. That's for the whole nation. And so, you know, let's get real about who is watching this and who isn't. And actually the effort that's needed to do, I mean, to pull this off, I've said this before, to pull this off really well, it probably requires a good quarter to half your week. You're going to do this to the standard that's going to keep an that's going to attract 200-400 people.
I think, I mean, to the document again, there's one page where they sort of start coming into some of the problems the church faced. It's theme four, they call it, a call for the church to be authentic. But there are some really odd things in there. Keeping a focus on God while stripping away some of the demands or burdens of church. And you think, well, they've not got a vision. They've not got a biblical vision of what a church is here going on. And it turns out that actually the picture of a church they're looking at in the reflection here, they say, we noticed that several non-churchgoers had a clear picture of the church's purpose, mostly built around inclusion, universal accessibility, and providing an open space of hospitality and spirituality. Well, that's not, none of those are in fact the church's purpose.
Yeah. So what they want is something, a website for their digital church that's a cross between Finhorn and the John Lewis website and the John Lewis platform, isn't it, really? You know, where you can just go and have an online experience if you can't be bothered to go to the shop or the commune.
It's a really
weird, and it's sort of, and there's a sort of whole problem of what the role of clergy, because this is written by clergy, it must be said, there's a whole list of reverends who've written it, and they seem to have forgotten, and I think the church has a real issue with this, that our job isn't actually to sort of just simply respond to what people think they want, but it's to lead people into what Christ wants. So when it says, as one of the surprises, there was very little resentment from regular churchgoers that specific types of worship have been lost, for example, very few commented on the lack of Holy Communion, that is a huge lack of leadership across the whole diocese. They say, because they're failing, the church is failing to teach the disciples in the church what it is to be a Christian. Because if they knew what it was to be a Christian, they wouldn't be sat around saying, oh, we didn't really miss Holy Communion. Again, it's astonishing.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, it's completely back to front. It's like, well, what we're going to do is we're going to listen to a bunch of people
Some of whom don't even go to church, not even Christians.
Some of whom don't. I mean, I care about what people who don't go to church think, but, you know, it's not really up to them to determine the identity of the church. And we're gonna listen to the views of people who we've catechized, or rather haven't catechized, and then respond to them as though we have to sort of continue in the false direction that we've already been going. I mean,
it's sort of consumerism, isn't it, at its heart?
Yeah,
it's a consumer-led church.
Yes, I mean the first. So they've come up with these themes, which are really sort of groups of findings, and the first one is, that they found there was a desire not to return to the way things were. And I just think, just, I mean, there's a lot of stuff written here, but I just think that that is astonishing, isn't it? I mean, that's like, and you can see in these points that they've written that that's basically all about Sunday services and basically any services. I mean, the respondents were very positive about the speed and variety of actions. Oh, that's the thing about how great the church has been, which we've already spoken about. There's one part here. So feedback suggests that the value of people coming together in God's name in small and large groups is more important than the traditional services of worship. Some aspects of liturgy and traditional services were not missed. Cessation of regular worship brought a real liberation for some respondents, with freedom from associated workloads, etc., etc. Oh yeah, less travel to venues for meetings is a benefit to the environment. Right, let's not go to church anymore for the environment, right?
And well, I mean, to be honest, that's probably talking more about the more useless meetings in this world, in the ecclesiastical world.
I've got no problem getting rid of all the time wasting, you know, committee meetings and things like that. They've got it exactly the wrong way around. It's like they're trying to advocate more of those kind of things, and no Sunday. So here, both clergy and lay people express relief at the absence of the weekly routine of Sunday services. When we gather together to worship the risen Christ and to receive his body and blood, which confers on us immortality and everlasting life. I mean, what is this document? And this is something I wanted to ask you boys. What do you actually think is behind this? Because to me, this has an agenda. The agenda is to move the church out of the parish and online, because they imagine that that will be cheaper and that will be more effective. That's my, I don't know. Yeah. What do you think?
And also it's fashionable, it's trendy, it's kind of got a glitz to it. You know, there's a whole kind of fantasy around that, which as I mentioned earlier, sort of comes out of the kind of consumerist progressive theology, which is essentially give people what they want. And all that, you know, it's that, to quote Ratzinger, it's that, I'm forgetting the actual theological words, it's the hermeneutic of discontinuity. In other words, it's looking at the past as always needs to be poo-pooed. Everything has happened before. Yeah, only the current moment exists. We have to be in a state of perpetual revolution or progression. So anything old is to be marred as boring. You know, this is so the past is a stale expression of church.
Yeah,
and this is all fresh and new, and this is what we should be grabbing hold of. And of course, if you do that, you have no grammar. That diocese is going to evaporate into nothing.
It will die.
Well, presumably, I mean, yeah. And I think a lot of the things they say about the benefits, they claim the benefits for online church in their theme 3, online church is here to stay, are actually serious negatives. Online church offers increased opportunity to see content from other churches, to access it as alternative, to compare. I mean, I don't know if any of them have ever read Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, but this is literally one of the things that Screwtape advises his nephew, who's another demon. If any listeners haven't read it, it's a great book. It's very funny. It's very funny, and it's full of spiritual truths. And it's about a demon, a greater demon, writing to his nephew, who's a lesser tempter, about the life of this human who they're trying to win for the devil. And one of the things he says is, you know, try and encourage him to go to different churches, because, you know, you start experiencing church as a consumer and not as a disciple or as a receiver of wisdom, receive wisdom, but as someone who's there just to have a good time. And he said that is no better way of winning a soul for hell than to do that. And here they are, increased opportunity to see content from other churches. You know, it's astonishing. I mean, my friend sort of had a little commentary to go with it. He said, the conclusion seems to be that public worship is just too much trouble and both clergy and laity can't be bothered with it. No wonder the church is in decline when its own leadership seems so unenthusiastic about what it does. We're quite...
Yeah.
You know what this is like? Sorry, chaps, just an analogy. This is like if football was banned currently, and then the FA did a survey, and they came out and said, you know what? Actually going to watch football matches and having real football is really onerous and boring. And what we're actually going to do is we're going to encourage everyone to play FIFA online, yeah, right? And they can just all play virtual football, and that will be just as good. People would look at that and think, do you even like football? You know, do you actually like football? Because if you did, you wouldn't say that. And I think the world is looking at this and thinking, and Christians are looking at this and thinking, do you like God? You know, do you like the church? Do you like Jesus? Because this sounds like you can't be bothered. It really does just sound like you cannot be bothered. And it sounds like vicars would prefer to sit around in their pajamas, go on the computer for half an hour on Sunday, dash out some online service, and then just get back to their everyday business. And if that is the intention of vicars or their motivation, I just think it's a total abdication of responsibility. And
I'd like to confirm I'm not wearing the pyjamas.
That's good, Daniel. That's good.
And I just rest at this point, you know.
Just let me finish this rant, right? Because I think it's important to say this, right? I've got absolute confidence that the way that we reach this culture is through the actual church, right? Actual church, with people meeting in community, listening to the word of God preached and receiving the sacraments. That is the way to reach the culture. And if you do that well, people will come. One of the reasons is, and I could go on about this a lot, but one of the reasons is that people are desperate for real community. They're absolutely desperate. We live in the most atomized society that there has ever been. Loneliness is the ultimate pandemic of our society, right? And when people come in and they feel the love and the warmth of other human beings in a church, that is something that the vast majority of people, I would guess 90 to 95% of people, don't ever experience, right? Because we're so isolated. We've totally lost that sense of community. And the church is one of the few remaining places in our society where you can have it. Now, that's not all the churches, but that is such a strength. That's what drew me into the church to begin with. And I was 19, right? I was a 19-year-old. I was exactly the kind of person, apart from the fact that I'm not black, but I'm exactly the kind of person that the Church of England wants to attract. Right. And they're doing the exact opposite of what they should be. Literally the opposite. They're saying that young people will respond to this. And I'm saying it's absolute rubbish. You're throwing away your most powerful weapons. You know, these weapons are supercharged by the Holy Spirit, and you're throwing them away for this, you know, this bowl of pottage. You know, it's supreme folly. It's not just an abdication. It's foolish because it's not going to achieve what these people want. Okay, rant over. Someone else.
No, you know, I remember a year ago when we could download from Church House posters that said we're still open, and then a few days later we were told to take them all down and close. Yeah. And we weren't even allowed to go into our churches.
Yeah.
And I found it astonishing in this year, going on the back of your rant,
yeah,
how we have committed Harry Carey in so many different ways as a denomination. And I'm sure it's happened in other denominations too, when we have this... We have this gift and these facilities to offer community and spiritual community nonetheless as well. And we've decided, oh, it's a bit unsafe to do so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in the last 2-3 months, what have we seen? I mean, let's be open. The majority of churches deciding it's too dangerous to have public gatherings in their buildings,
yep,
to have worship. And yet we were the only institution allowed to do that.
Yep.
And I said, well, actually, it's still too dangerous.
Yep. Yeah.
And then we wonder why we're seeing, you know, 1 in 4 people, 1 in 4 children coming out with mental health mental health problems, in utter despair, lonely, seeing the very centre of their communities. You know, churches are at the heart of villages and towns for a purpose. They were put in the centre to mean something.
Yeah.
And we closed the door on that. I can remember this time last year, the few days that followed, and then when the Church of England went beyond what was asked of it, I sat in this office and had a bit of quite a weep. I just thought, this is the church self-harming itself.
Yeah.
Why are we doing this?
Yeah. The thing is, Daniel, I think that it's the feeling that I get increasingly is that this is the reason why. I mean, there are other reasons as well, I think, but I think ultimately the reason why is because this suits this agenda, doesn't it? Which is to close parish churches, to put everything online, to reduce costs, ultimately to reduce clergy numbers. And that's it must have been a pre-existing agenda, you know. Now I don't want anyone to call me a conspiracy theorist, as you know, plenty of people have, but it just seems to be inexplicable otherwise. And I wasn't aware of this. I've only just become aware of this. But when I see things like this, and I, you know, and with all the stuff last year, you have to think, yeah, that's the reason why. It must be.
But if your dominant theology is one that excises heaven and the transcendent and the sacraments in replacement for the noble supposedly ideas of social justice, inclusion, and etc. If you make the project of the kingdom of God simply just about things earthly, this is what happens. Yeah. And the sacraments are replaced, bread and wine is replaced by safety, and so on, and everything, you know. So we have a church whose theology is curled in on itself.
Yeah.
And this is what we get. This is a conclusion from this.
Yeah. Tom, do you want to say anything more about this document, or shall we move on to the Douglas Murray article? Because I'd like to talk about that.
Yeah.
I think we should move on. Yeah.
Okay. So Douglas Murray's written this article, which is in the Spectator, called "The Church of England's New Religion," and basically, he's got hold of the findings of an anti-racist task force that has been set up in the central Church of England. He writes, "The Archbishop's task force seeks to build on." Sorry, I'll start that again. The Archbishop's task force notes that much has happened. Oh, sorry, boys, I'm really messing this up. It starts with this quotation from the Archbishop of Canterbury from February last year. "I'm sorry and ashamed. I'm ashamed of our history and I'm ashamed of our failure. There is no doubt when we look at our own church that we are still deeply institutionally racist." Originally worded insight. "The Archbishop's task force seeks to build on this position. As it notes, much happened in the months after the Archbishop's admission of racism. In May last year, George Floyd was killed by a policeman in Minnesota. The C of E report describes Floyd as, quotation, this is unbelievable, a 46-year-old practicing Christian who worked to mentor young people and oppose gun violence. Murray comments, which is certainly a generous interpretation of Floyd's varied career. It is anyway the only generous interpretation in the report, which warns fantastically elsewhere of racism whispered in our pews, as though the Church of England was the KKK at prayer. When talking of the institutional racism that is allegedly so rife in the church, the report insists the time for lament at such treatment is over. The time for action has now come." So then he goes on to talk about what the action actually is. And basically there's quite a lot of stuff about there'll be lots of quotas. So there should be one UK ME, which means UK minority ethnic clergy, elected for each region. I don't know what a region actually is. Do any of you boys know? No. So I don't know whether that means diocese, but you'd think that's pretty low. Something called program cohort should have a minimum of 30% UK ME participation in order to build up pipeline supply. I think that's about the movers and shakers, isn't it? The Archbishop's movers and shakers who are sort of being built up in the pipeline to become bishops and deans. So that's got to be 30%. And in that happy bureaucraties in which the C of E excels, the church should develop an online module for anti-racist learning program. All shortlists will include at least one appointable UK ME candidate. And where this does not occur, the recruiter should provide valid, publishable reasons for failures, and so on and so forth. There's also a thing in here about, I think it's 30% of ordinands are going to have to be UK ME as well. And the curriculum for ordinands must include participation in an introductory Black theology module, which is what you were talking about earlier, Tom, which you've already done. So
it wasn't a specific Black theology module. It was just, you know, as I said, it was Black theology examined because it was interesting, because it was because it had something to say, because it was a good counter to, I think, the over-reliance on sort of Enlightenment theology in the Western Church. It stood on its own merits, in other words. So, I mean, so it's probably not enough, really, is it? I should have been, you know, spent a bit of time flagellating myself as well. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, the interesting thing is, I'm quite happy now. I've got the type, I've got the word processor here. Gosh, that sounds very 1990s, isn't it? I got the desktop here. I'm happy to write a letter to the Archbishop of Nigeria to say we need more ethnic minority clergy. Please send us enough to fill the 30%, because I think they would be more than willing to do that for us. I know that there was another Spectator editor writer who wrote about this. I can't think of his name at the moment. But you know, the African churches would happily come and re-evangelize us. I'm not sure that the progressive element of the church would be as welcoming. I saw this happen in Aberdeen when I was a parish priest and university chaplain there, a huge Nigerian community. Mostly Christian, largely Anglican, and Aberdeen Diocese is quite conservative, but they thought we were wet. And so a lot of them organised themselves with non-stipendiary clergy from Nigeria into house groups around the city. There were 30 groups. I got into a few of them, and we befriended some and that, but the local indigenous clergy just didn't want to mix, you know. So what, you know, racism can go both ways, can't it? Really, in terms of sometimes it can be progressives not wanting people from ethnic communities because they think their theology is too traditional.
Yeah, and they inevitably characterise it as regressive and.
Oh yeah, I've had, yeah. What would you want to be hanging around with that lot for? They're, you know, backward. That's terribly insulting, really.
Well, it's quite sort of colonialist, isn't it?
It is actually, yeah. Yeah, we know better.
Ironic, really.
Yeah, it is so ironic. But yeah, I'm happy to write a letter to some African bishops now and say, please send us clergy. You know,
I'd love it if these
people are
all filled.
Come over.
People from Africa.
Please, yeah. Reverence, yeah. Please come over.
that would be fantastic. Yeah, I mean, obviously, this whole thing about quotas, I find really disturbing because, you know, ordinands, and I'm certain it'll be the same thing with appointments to churches as well. It's all couched in the language of we're discerning who God's will is for this post, right? And it seems to me that having a quota fundamentally mitigates against the idea that this is God's decision, right? Because it's not really God's decision, is it? If you've decided that 30% of ordinands have to be BAME, then you're deciding for God, you know? And ultimately what will happen is that BAME people will be put forward who are inappropriate in a desire to fulfill the quota. And worse, maybe worse, I don't know, is that white people will not be put forward who otherwise might have been, which is just racist and discriminatory. And it also means that it's a denial of those people's calling. So I just think the whole idea of a quota for these posts is, you know, it's just absurd, really. I mean, I can understand wanting to make opportunities for anyone who wants to come forward as easy as possible. But it should be fair. It shouldn't be, you know, well, we have to have quotas. It should just be, well, let's make it possible. And then we'll evaluate it on a case-by-case basis.
And the biggest bias in the Church of England has been, we know, for the last 200 years, I mean, Oscar Wilde picked up on this, didn't he? When he said we were full of a church of respectable people. We'd yeah. rather be in a church of sinners. That we are a very middle-class operation on the whole.
Yeah.
Selection processes and all this is a highly middle-class instrument. I've had interns from traditional working-class backgrounds who found it really intimidating. Do you know, a week before going on to your bishop's selection conference, it's very intimidating if, as we have one lad who, you know, grew up in very heroically in a very rough council estate, to receive a letter telling it that these are your selectors, you know, and the Reverend Canon Dr. Professor so-and-so yeah. loves nothing better than yachting in the Greek islands. I joke not. Opera singing with her husband and the finer points of Latin exegesis,
yeah.
you know, blah, blah, yeah. blah. If you get that thrown at you, you think it has written, I actually wrote a letter of complaint. It smelled all over it of, I am not going to fit in with this yeah. club.
Well, yeah.
This
we
is where the bias is. It's class. It's not race. Yeah.
We spoke with Phil Saker. Church of England
is institutionally class ridden.
We spoke about class with Phil Saker a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about the sort of somewhere, anywhere sort of dichotomy, which I've been doing some thinking about, because inevitably clergy are anywhere people on the whole. Because we're expected to move around and settle in and, you know, be at home in a variety of different places. But we minister on the whole. And it's one of the reasons I think that that rural ministry is sneered at. It tends to be somewheres. People who have a deep sense of identity with where they are, the community they're in, the village. I'm a somewhere, personally. I don't really like moving around. I like putting down roots and staying there. But I think we tend to draw from, well, because the university educated anywheres, effectively, people who, you know, you could plonk them down in any metropolitan area and they'd get on. And a lot of our mission, a lot of the successful mission has been anywheres as well. You know, HTB is very anywhere church. Mm. I mean, they do pay lip service to the context that they're planting into. Mm. But in the end, they attract a sort of middle class, attractive white population. Which I think is, you know, it's needs to change, and it most of obviously has problems when you end up with a church that the congregation sort of vote conservative. Not again, maybe, but for, you know, to a degree of you know, something like 60% conservative, yeah. whereas it's something like 3% of the clergy. Yeah. And even that 3% probably aren't going to vote them again. So, oh well, Boris. But anyway.
I won't be, that's for sure.
I won't be. I can't anymore. I just couldn't. Not while this leadership's in place. But anyway.
Tom, you're absolutely right. And it's another, and so are you, Daniel. I mean, it's another area where the church is just completely blind to the huge, huge swathe of society that it alienates, namely the working class, and it doesn't address that problem at all. But it's obsessed with the question of race,
and the online church thing is going to make that even worse. Because let's be honest, online church is a purview. It's just a middle class, middle aged thing. I mean, no one else does it.
Yeah.
No one else does it.
Absolutely, chaps. We've been talking about the church quite a long time now. I think we should just move on to some discussion of other events. Is that all right? Well, it's been a year since the lockdown, so that was on Tuesday. Did you chaps do any reflecting on that? Boris called us to reflect, I think. Did you do any of that? Did you reflect?
I didn't reflect. Daniel, I said a prayer for victims, but
well, we have midday prayer in our church, lay led every day anyway, so you know, we weren't being asked to do anything different. I felt quite angry about the whole thing, actually, to be honest. I wrote something in my blog, as you may have seen, because it seemed to me that we were being asked to reflect from a very neutral point of view. And this is where the church keeps trying to do this, put itself in this neutral, supposedly unbiased space where it seems very convenient to ramp up rage on issues that are fashionable.
Yeah.
But there's no mix within the church's message in this last year, officially. You know, we used to be a denomination that prided itself in debate and in having, you know, even if you thought they were eccentric prelates, people who came on the telly and the airwaves or wrote books that showed that there was a vibrant discussion. And there hasn't been a vibrant theological discussion on the merits otherwise of lockdown. So, you know, if you're really suffering from lockdown, if you've died, if you know someone who's died because of lockdown, what does this day of reflection say? It says, oh, well, that's a kind of almost like a side effect. It's collateral damage.
Yeah.
To the main thing. And I found myself thinking, you know, why can't some people in the senior parts of the church come up and say what Lord Sumption said about things like, you know, if a convention is broken, it ceases to become a convention.
Yep.
And that there's a danger that we might have seen this time last year the death of liberal democracy in our country.
Yep.
You know, even if there were one or two eccentric voices higher up the food chain came and said that would at least be reassuring. But to have this radio silence, to say, we'll have a day of reflection, I understand that. Why nobody's disclaiming the enormity of the deaths and what's happened and the tragedy. But there is another dimension to this. That, you know, what about acknowledging, for instance, the mental health issues that we've put upon our children, the sacrifices to their education?
Yeah.
That's not being reflected upon.
I think the main issue is that it sort of serves at the moment to buy the whole thing, the way it was phrased by Boris Johnson, the way it was introduced. You know, the cynic in me says this is just propaganda, because what they're doing is they're deflecting as much as possible away from questions of, you know, should we have locked down, and just building more and more, we should definitely have locked down, look how many people have died, think about how many people could have died if we hadn't. And that's what they want you to think. And that's what they think, I think, you know. That whole narrative is built up on some very dubious assumptions, one of which is that liberal democracy, liberalism, freedom is not really worth anything, that it's just an intangible thing that's nice to have when you can, but actually when it comes to it, it doesn't really matter, which I think is wrong. I think it's all right to think that's wrong. You know, it's almost as if people would say, oh, well, you do value freedom more than life. Well, yes, I do value freedom more than life. I mean, it's going back 80 years, and we fought a world war and sacrificed our finest men and women because we believed that freedom was worth more than, yeah, more than life. Do I think we should have abandoned democracy, liberal democracy, to counter a pandemic, even if that pandemic had been a lot worse or just as bad as Neil Ferguson has said? Well, no, I don't think that. And neither did the government. I mean, the pre-pandemic preparedness plan allowed for nearly as many deaths as Neil Ferguson's model. And all that said was, well, we try and keep life as normal as possible, not we end life as, you know, for as long as we need to.
Yeah.
But then, of course, even those things aside, we look around and we look at those places that are more free than us. We look at Sweden, we look at Florida, we look at And we look at Denmark, you know, people say, oh, well, Denmark did a lot better than Sweden. Well, they didn't really have a lockdown. Come on now, you could still meet people indoors for the whole of their first lockdown. And you think, and you realize that actually something's wrong in the models because they don't account for those. They literally don't account for them.
Yeah.
And you realize that actually there's a narrative being spun. So that's why I didn't celebrate or reflect, or celebrate, not celebrate, didn't reflect on that, because I felt that we've been in the middle of a narrative that's being spun that they will defend to the limit of their political credibility, because if they don't defend it, then they will have no choice but to leave public administration forever for good, you know.
And possibly to be tried and imprisoned for their crimes. I just think the whole idea of having an anniversary for the announcement, the illegal announcement of a lockdown, to be perverse. There was no legal basis for the lockdown when it was first called. You cannot, as the Prime Minister, you cannot tell people that they can't leave their homes and that the police will arrest them unless the legislation has gone through Parliament. And it hadn't gone through Parliament on Monday, the 23rd of March. So it was an illegal lockdown. It was illegal what Boris Johnson did, which I'm pretty sure is a crime. I think that makes him a criminal, personally. So it was an illegal action. It was a crime. It was unconstitutional. And, you know, just that fact alone should give you some indication that the symbolic date of March 23rd is not a good thing, not a good date to observe as though that was a legitimate action, because it wasn't. And the whole narrative is part of the problem is this narrative is very, very simple. So it's easy for people to get. That's part of the genius of this propaganda. It's 120,000 people have died. And, you know, and this is a massive tragedy. And that's what justifies all these things. It's more complicated to actually think about the way other people's lives have been affected, and the fact that hundreds of thousands of people have died as a result of the lockdown. That figure of 120,000 is like a battering ram to get through everything. And the figure, as we know, is false. It's a false figure. What that figure is the amount of people who have died of any cause within 28 days of a positive test. That's a significantly different thing to 120,000 people dying of COVID. It's significantly different. It leaves out the fact that they could have died of other causes, that even if they did have COVID, the other causes, there could be other causes of death as well. And in the vast majority of cases, there were. It leaves out the fact that the majority of people who have died, the vast majority have been over 80. And the actual average age of death is higher than the life expectancy than the normal life expectancy, which is 82, and the average age of death of these people is 83. So it's enormously misleading, this thing, and it keeps on being repeated, even in conservative sources. I was hearing it repeated on talk radio recently, and of course the church has repeated this as well. But it's just false. It's just not true. It's not true.
I think the key is to think about excess deaths. And the reason they don't want you to think about excess deaths is because they're a lot lower, about 80,000 over the year. Over the year and a half since last year. But also that they are inclusive, not just of deaths from COVID, but substantial chunks of excess deaths in the home. But even, as I say, even all that aside, I mean, in a sense, that's quibbling. Even all that aside, is our freedom so? Should I say it this way? Are we a people? Are we a country? Are we a historical country that sticks by its values, or do we drop them the moment the going gets tough? In which case, are they really values? The values of Britain, not the nonsense ones they teach in school, but to me are sort of summed up really in the human rights declarations, mostly because they took a lot of their inherent rights from the common law system that we brought to the world. Which is to say that we're free to meet people, we're free to say what we want, we're free to protest against the government, we're free to exercise religion, as long as we don't, you know. In other countries, in China, they have no rights. All they have is what the state can. They are permitted to do things the state allows them to. In England, until a year ago, we were permitted to do anything we wanted to as long as the state didn't forbid it. We've become much more akin to communist China. And Matt Hancock himself said that, you know, we're going to a civil law system, he said. You know, we're abandoning common law. If common law, which has done us well for 300 years and through many, many, many pandemics, it can be abandoned just like that on the whim of a government minister, then we don't really have it. Everything is just in their purview and their gifts. And as Lord Sumption says, we're now at the mercy of any minister who wants to come along and declare that they think it's necessary to take away one of the rights that I thought I was born with inherently. And that makes me very, very angry.
Mm. It's very scary, isn't it? The last few weeks, I felt deeply apprehensive.
Yeah, me too.
About the months and weeks ahead, in a way that I never imagined I would be. And I think the convention has been broken. We now know that our rights are the gift of the states, our overlords. They are not natural freedoms, that they have no divine origin. They are purely there as conveniences when our masters decide we can have them. And when you hear Chris Whitty this week saying, well, COVID could be with us forever.
Yep.
What are we supposed to think about that? You know.
And all of the sort of nonsense that we keep hearing from, I mean, Boris Johnson yesterday, you know, pubs may be free to not allow people in with vaccines, you know, and various other things that go against our sort of sense of freedom and fair play that the government, the country has always had, I think.
They said people who are not vaccinated might not be able to go into pubs.
And I just think, it's quite clear now that Just as we said, the government don't really plan to stop everything on the 21st of June. They're going to keep things in the statute books. They're going to permit things and resource things that are deeply illiberal. Even, you know, we said a couple of weeks ago that if the government decided to not have its own vaccine passport, but by default allow other people to do it, then it's just as bad as the government just having one. You may as well just have one, the state run. At least we know where we stand.
I personally don't think it's as bad, Tom, but we did talk about this last week. If the government institutes a vaccine passport, which is a legal thing, a legal document, then the police could literally just stop you and ask you for it wherever you are in the country. They could restrict you from going outside of your house, which I think is the worst case scenario. I do agree with you. The other scenario is very bad as well. But if the police could, the police could stop you and demand that you issue your vaccine passport, that's a nightmare.
I don't think that's what we're going to see, Jamie. I think we're going to see a sort of soft vaccine passport where...
All I'm saying is it's just not as bad.
No, it might not be as bad, but it's still coercion. It's still antithetical to a liberal state.
It is. It's just you said it's almost as bad. I'm just saying I don't think it's as bad. But I tell you what I do think is bad. If you look at what's going on in Israel, this already is happening there. Like the kind of thing you described, Tom. The disturbing thing I found out yesterday is that certain churches are now saying that unvaccinated people can't come in Israel. And that is really worrying. And I as you know, I've been talking about this for months now as something that I thought was a possibility. This is literally a heresy to divide the body of Christ on the basis of what medical treatment people have had. It's a heresy. And I'm concerned about this. I'm concerned that this is going to start happening here as well.
And yeah, I noticed the government has asked that Boris seems to be suggesting that care workers, those working in the care sector, should have an immunity healthcare jab passport, whatever you call it. No jab, no job. Now, my worry would be that a denomination like ours could decide off its own back to jump on that bandwagon.
Yep.
Start to ask that all clergy have to have an immunity passport, church wardens, visitors for Eucharistic ministry, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
It'll happen through the safeguarding legislation if it happens at all, won't it?
There's
a safeguarding risk. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
they have a big voice within the Church of England.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if it does happen, boys, I think I would just probably leave the church, if I'm honest with you, because it would be literally a heresy, whether it was just for clergy or for everyone. You know, I've been reading this book about Dietrich Bonhoeffer this week, and it's an analogous situation with the German church in the 1930s, because the Nazis started segregating the church on the basis of race. Right. So the state said, right, the church must be segregated in this way because of the superiority of the German race. And that was a heresy that Dietrich Bonhoeffer saw through and rejected. And we have to reject this, you know, pure and simple. This is a division of the body of Christ. It's a false gospel. It's a denial of the true gospel, which is about the dividing wall of hostility between Jew and Gentile and all divisions broken down through Christ. And it's an assault on the identity of the church. So if this happens, this will be crossing a line, which is, you know, it's I don't even know what to say. It couldn't be more serious. It literally couldn't be more serious. So let's hope it doesn't.
Did you see the? I think I showed you earlier in the week an app, an online demonstration of I think it was a Danish app, if I remember rightly.
Yeah.
It was 10-minute little cartoon about how this family have different levels of immunity. Dad's been jabbed. The son is too young to be jabbed. Mum's pregnant, so she can't be jabbed. So she has an exemption.
Yeah.
And so on. And to where they could sit in the football stadium, to what pubs they can go to. You know, and then when Freddie grows up and go to university, he'll have to get the jab to go to lectures. And then George, who's the dad, you know, he can, as an employer on his app, he can scroll through his list of employees who can demonstrate their status.
Yeah.
And then he can send them text messages telling them whether to turn up or not.
Yeah.
And it's all very dynamic, you know, presented as if it was that, you know, remember that app Mondays that allows you to organize? It had that kind of glossy, glitzy feeling to it, you know, and everybody has a QR code and a profile picture, and it's just a case of bing, bing, and you're in or you're out. Yeah.
I think that society is the one when I move into the Welsh Hills and become a sheep farmer.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
what really kind of is keeping me up at night is thinking this could be like in 2-3 weeks' time.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah,
I was quite prepared for the, you know, if we were going to have the woke-topia the next 3, 4, 5 years, think, well, yes, I might go and find some place on Dartmoor and my family. But, you know, 2 weeks is 2-3 weeks coming is.
I think one of the key things everyone can do is listening, is go and fill out the consultation. Now, I mean, the cynic in me says the consultation is simply there to bread, you know, butter the bread of make it look like they've done the whole job. But there is a consultation for vaccine certification. They've changed the name from passport to certification, probably because they kept promising they wouldn't do passports. But we will do some certificates.
Yeah.
And you know, just register with your MP that, you know, because the Parliament has actually spoken against this. They debated, and I think that it was quite clearly the will of Parliament in that debate. It has no legal standing, of course. They can change their mind, but was that this was a bad idea?
Well, it was self-selecting. I think Tom, the people who decided to be there were people who opposed it, but there are people who are for it who decided not to go because they don't want to say outright they're for it, because it would be a controversial thing to say. I mean, it does seem that things are going in this direction. One thing I wanted to just raise with you chaps is that there was this huge protest on Saturday, which was largely ignored by the media.
It was wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And where it was reported, it was falsely reported as a violent protest. I watched footage of it for about an hour while it was going on, and there was absolutely no violence whatsoever. And I tuned in towards the end of the day as well.
Well, the only violence
One thing. The only violence I saw was a police officer kicking a protester on the ground after the protester had been arrested by about five officers. They bundled him on the ground, and then one of the police officers kicked him twice, I think. So that's the only violence I saw. Sorry, Tom.
I mean, I think one of the convenient things for this narrative is that there was violence at the Bristol protest. Oh, Daniel's gone.
No, I'm back.
Oh, you're back. Oh, there we are. There was violence at the Bristol protest.
That was for a different thing, though. Well, that was against the policing bill. That wasn't a lockdown protest.
Yeah, although protest against the policing bill is also a very good thing to do, I think.
I'm not sure, Tom. I think that's more mixed up with other political agendas, which might not entirely tally with the anti-lockdown message.
Maybe not, but the policing bill is quite a sinister bill.
Yeah,
some of the bits about protest and they're effectively, in the name of removing some protests like the
BLM and the Antifa stuff.
Yeah, they're basically stopping. Well, any police can stop any protest now without really having to worry about it. Well, anyway,
it would. They can imprison people for 10 years for causing a disturbance.
They're like 10 years, don't they? £10,000, 10 years. What is it with this government?
We were talking about this last week.
It's the only number they can think of, isn't it? Yeah.
Let's hope it's not 40.
Yeah, but just one more thing on this. Like, there were literally tens of thousands of people at this protest. It was massively underreported with headlines like hundreds of people. It's just a lie. You could literally see these lines. You could see it was as far as the eye could see the amount of people who were there. And it was actually really heartening. I saw one old fellow who was probably in his 80s going along with he was holding two Union Jacks. Shouting, stand up, take your freedom back. And I was thinking, this guy probably lived through the Second World War, you know, and he probably has a much greater grasp of the freedom that this country has fought for and suffered for than the people around him, and certainly more than the people who are enacting these ghastly authoritarian lockdowns. And it was really heartening. And like we said with Phil Saker, this government is going absolutely rogue, authoritarian, totalitarian for sure, but we don't know how people are going to respond. It could be that the people will rise up en masse and make a real difference. We just don't know. I mean, it's a shame we're so far away from a general election, because that might make a difference.
We've got the May elections coming up, haven't we? So maybe that'll be a time to register your electoral dissatisfaction. But quite who you vote for, I don't know. I think Reform have a party who are anti-lockdown, aren't they? Reform.
Yeah, they do. And there's also the Reclaim party as well. I'm not sure how that works vis-a-vis the elections.
I was interested to see yesterday Lawrence Fox videoed a visit. Did you see that?
Yeah, I saw
a visit from the police.
Yeah.
Rather than nervy looking police officers who clearly had been told by someone
Daddy
to I was trying to be polite there, maybe I shouldn't be polite, you know. Clearly had been told to go and interview him, reminding him that he is a mayoral candidate. And it was the most bizarre thing to see, you know.
Yeah, and warning him that somebody had said that he may have broken some
rule.
Yeah, and they didn't have any evidence, but they just wanted to warn him that, you know, not to do it again. It was weird, wasn't it?
This is exactly the sort of thing that we would have sneered at in East Germany. You know, a politician candidate, even an outsider, you know, has visits from the police to warn them about their campaigning. You know, no evidence, but we've been told you've been a very naughty boy.
It's all the time moving away from this idea that the police are there just to enforce the law. So somebody breaks the law, they're arrested by the police, right? That's what the police are there to do. They're not there to, you know, go and warn people that, you know, they think they might have broken the law. They're not there to try and work out what people are thinking and warn them that they're thinking the wrong thing. They're not there to tell people that something they've said on Twitter is offensive. That's not why the police exist, but it is increasingly moving in that direction. Hey, listen, boys, I think we should probably wrap things up reasonably soon, because we've been going for quite a long time. I do want to share email of the week, though, which I've chosen. This is from a chap called Mikey, who is a Buddhist. I thought this would be interesting. He talks about how much he enjoys the show and so on. And he says, also as a lockdown skeptic, I'm finding it interesting and encouraging that in these crazy times, people are finding companionship and nourishment in unexpected places. I have most experience in the Buddhist world, but my impression is that all the major faith traditions are buying into COVID orthodoxy and supporting lockdowns. Very interesting. Remarkable, really, when we all in different ways highlight the transience of human life and the vanity and futility of self-seeking ultimate satisfaction via this physical body. So you might think that this crisis, like historical plagues, would be an opportunity for the church to preach the gospel of salvation in Christ. But the main message seems to be wash your hands, wear your mask, get vaccinated and be nice to your neighbours. It's pretty much the same in Buddhism. Which I didn't know this. All public gatherings and retreats have been put on hold and safetyism is everywhere. There seem to be some dark forces at work. And then in a second email, which I think this is really interesting, he writes, what might be a starting point is how lockdown has exposed the degree to which many faith traditions have succumbed to secular materialism and thence wokeism, which is fast becoming a religion of its own. I can see many reasons for this within Buddhism. I can see many reasons for this with Buddhism, partly to do with the demographic it appeals to, but mainly because of the insight Buddhism promotes into contingency or dependent co-arising. This is the view of phenomena as being in a continual state of flux and becoming with no pre-existing essence in anything, thus ruling out the notion of an individual soul or creator God. In the tradition and the teachings of Buddha, the pursuit of this insight is always on the basis of a strong ethical code and within the context of an intentional community. But freed of what are seen as these cultural constraints, Westerners can adapt their own pick and mix spirituality in which there are no overarching moral constraints and one pursues what makes one feel good and virtuous in the moment. Moral relativism and the pursuit of a secular paradise here on earth follows as night follows day. I thought that was very interesting when he said that it's always on the basis of a strong ethical code and within the context of an intentional community. When we're bearing in mind what we were talking about earlier about this assault on the idea of the gathered church, they want to be freed of these because they're seen as cultural constraints. And that's exactly the same thing I would say that Bath and Wells document was saying. It was talking about being freed from the constraints of gathered worship, and then that leading to moral relativism and the pursuit of a secular paradise. I think that's very, very similar to what's going on in our church. But yeah, quite interesting. So if any other Buddhists want to get in touch, or any other religions or faiths,
delighted to hear. Yeah.
It's all very interesting, and to see. I mean, you know, that basically it seems that all major faiths are responding in the same way. So I think he's right, probably, that it's something to do with the pervasiveness of secular materialism, you know, and how powerful secularism actually is, what a powerful force it is. It's taking the commas at the moment, for sure.
We've lost the vision of heaven.
Yes.
We don't have that. We see everything in the wrong perspective. Apparently cattle... The eyesight of cattle is such that they see the world the world around them in a much larger. You know, we look scary, like scary giants.
Yeah.
When we should be scared of them. Yeah. And I think, you know, have we ended up with cattle vision, where we're looking at the world around us and missing its true perspective?
Yeah, with huge balls of eyes. Yeah,
everything then gets curled up into. We must have a risk-free, safe world.
Yeah, absolutely.
And with that in mind, I thought, Jamie, I realised I haven't got my mask on.
Oh, yeah, you should put it on.
I should put it on.
Although, you know, these virus particles are 1 nanometre long, so they're too small to actually be caught by a mask, says our friend James. But you do look good in the mask, Daniel.
I'm ready to do surgery. Surgery of the heart. And I'm putting this on particularly for the lady that I passed by. Once again, driving down a country lane, 2-3 miles from anywhere, walking on the edge of a field, there was a couple both wearing masks.
Wow. There we are. I mean, it just, like, I think...
But last.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just shows you that people just don't, they're just, it's a superstition, isn't it? That's what it is. Anyway, chaps, I think we should leave it there today. I think we've gone round the houses and we've put the worlds to rights. And we just want to say to our listeners, thanks for listening to us and supporting us. listening to us and supporting us, I should say, do email us at irreverendpod@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at irreverendpods. And thank you, everybody, and God bless you. And, Tom.
As always, hold the hope of Christ in this dark world.
Indeed, indeed. Lift high the cross, especially as we approach Holy Week.
Will we do one next week for Holy Week?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, we'll do one next week. What about here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in and out of church a week, but I've got time during the day for sure. Yeah. So.
All right.
I think we should. We've got a duty to our listeners. As our listenership grows, we have an increasing sense of responsibility that they need us, Tom.
A Holy Week special.
All
right. Yeah. Well, if anyone wants to email anything in, some suggestion for a special Holy Week episode, please do. We'll be happy to do that for sure. Okay. So let's leave it there, boys. Thanks so much, Daniel. Thanks so much, Tom. Really good talking to you as always, and look forward to being with you again next week.
Take care.